There's a note here saying about the last dogs to come out of Harrick. Was that at that point?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Tell me about that, because I think that's... Bob Bosselman was with you at the time, I think.
Bob was with us. Bob was due to winter at Stonington, and of course all the dogs were due to go down to Stonington.
So what was happening? Why were they coming out of Harrick?
It was at the time when dog sledging really was, albeit Fuchs was still in charge, he was still director, but I think it was his last year down south anyway, and it was on the cards. Certainly dog sledging and exploration and so on was on the decline by then. And they'd probably, I'd imagine they'd finished all the planned work anyway using dog teams. Mechanised transport was coming in. And so they said, right, that's it. For whatever reason, they were got rid of them from Halley, and they were they were to go down to Sonnington. I can't remember how many, probably about a couple of dozen dogs, I'd imagine. I've got some slides I took of the one the Rhone Passage, and we had the guy who'd a chap called Neil McAllister, who'd already went at Stonington. He was on board as well, so he acted as a doggy man with Bob Bosselman, and they were weighing the dogs on passage and so on.
So they were living on deck?
They were all living out on the deck, on the open. Not actually on the heli deck. On the deck, beneath the heli deck, gave them a bit of shelter, but they were all tethered up. They didn't seem to... I don't think they particularly liked it in rough seas or anything, but I can't really remember. We didn't... it was a fairly good passage anyway. I seem to remember we went out via Cygne Island. There might have been a shore at Cygne for a few days. I can't remember, but I think that's probably what happened. So they had a day or so ashore before going back on board and then eventually down to Stonington.
Had you been to Stonington before at this point?
Oh, no, no.
So what was your first impression?
When we did eventually get ashore, it was everybody involved with relief, and I can't really remember whether I might have been working in the scow or something before I eventually got ashore. But it was all systems go to get that relief done right at the end of the season, and Stonington is prone to, you know, quite wild weather. So whilst the relief was happening, we did have 24 hours or so of really quite big blows from the northwest, really hitting the ship. So I was probably involved initially in the ferrying gear ashore, whatever. I eventually got on to base, and I was really looking forward to, of course, thinking, well, this is where I'm going to be wintering, to seeing meeting the dogs and so on. But the guy whose dog team I took over from, I didn't even get to talk to him really until about the day before Neil McNaughton, a geologist, and I said to him, "Yeah, I would like to see the dogs." Oh, he was ever so busy packing and so on. He said, "I'll take you up to meet the dogs." And eventually, of course, he did take me up there, and I met the dogs. But it was a very, very busy period, that relief there, everybody packing and new guys coming in and so on. So I can't honestly remember thinking in terms of, well, this is it, I'm going to be here for a couple of years, whatever. It was just so busy. Small island, and not a lot of snow about then, of course. It was all, the island was pretty barren, pretty bare, just bare rock everywhere.
The snow was seasonal, or had it gone completely by 73?
It was still very seasonal, and indeed still is today. It's, there's a good covering of snow over the winter period, even today, but... midsummer time at the end of the season there, just before the March time, before the ship finally sails, it is pretty bare, the island is, by then.
What was the hut like in those days? Do you remember much about it?
I do remember it. I was quite impressed with it. Lovely building, interesting building, and just as all the bases were in those days, just a hodgepodge of a bit tagged on here, a bit tagged on there, and again, as all the bases, you get incoming personnel, and somebody comes to the BC, thinks, well, it'd be nice to have that room as so-and-so rather than as it is now. And so Every group of people have got their own input and their own mark on the base. And but it was a very homely place, with the pot-bellied stoves, and the bar was lovely. And I can picture it today, the two guys that died in the storm, in fact, who'd built that bar. There were the two chaps on base, the radio op and, the diesel mechanic, I think it was. And they died they'd gone up for a bit of a jolly with the dog teams to the top of the Northeast Glacier, and they'd died in a bad storm anyway. But they'd, whilst they were on base, they'd built this lovely bar out of slight dry stone, or tiny bits of stone, 3-4 inches, whatever, in a semicircular bar with a fire in the middle of it, bar on top of that. And everybody would congregate round that bar, and above the bar there, all the dog teams carved in wood, the Admirals, the Comats, the Vikings and so on, and pictures of dog sledging around the room. So it was a very homely base. And that particular year, they were modifying the bunk rooms anyway. Tony Gannon, who was the builder for the winter, he got a load of timber and materials brought in to give a bit more privacy, I think, and the upstairs bunk room more partitioned off, just two people to a room. Well, very small, about, 5 foot by about 6 foot. But but it was a lovely homely base. It was what I expected. Certainly nothing like dramatic change nowadays. Of course, a lot of conditions are like, where you've got your own cabin and your own ensuite facilities and everything else. But a lovely base. It was great. I've been back more recently, and sadly, when they did close the base down, everything was taken out, and it's just a shell of a building now, and it's rather sad to see it.
Was it? Would Captain Scott have recognised it? Was it much advanced from Scott's day, or was it still in the heroic era?
I think it was still pretty much. Obviously we had electricity and electric lighting. But having said that, the diesel mechanic, John Newman, he'd only allow us lighting in the evenings for about 2 or 3 hours in the evening. Might have been a bit more in midwinter. But the old generator plodding away there, and when he flashed it up, so we had electric power. But it was still very much we had a few refinements, but it was pot-bellied stoves. Everybody involved with the day-to-day running of the base, which was nice, which I do feel is missing nowadays. You know, your scientists and people like that can just disappear into their own little caboose, whatever, and you never see them. But then, lunchtime, we all went in. We didn't have a cook on base, no cook, no doctor, so we took it in turns. And it was great. There were 14 of us wintered. And the system we were, water was very much at premium, particularly in the summer months, of course. The summer months, most of us were out in the field anyway. But snow blocking every lunchtime. So you'd have your lunch and then you go out and cut snow, everybody working together, a bit of coaling. So it was nice, that was. You were all working as a team, and very much, regardless whether you're a scientist or what, everybody's involved in it.
Did you have occasion to wish you did have a doctor?
I did have quite a nasty at one time. And Bob Bostman, of course, our vet, he looked after me, and Bob looked after all our medical needs.
Tell me the story. What happened to you?
Well, it was very early on. At my very first dog sledging field trip, so it was quite a steep learning curve. this was a good thing about Bass in those days. You had this changeover, people going down for a two-year contract. So you spend two full winter seasons down in the Antarctic. So I, as a first-year GA, general assistant, would go out with a second-year scientist and learn from him and so on. So it was my very first trip, and I was out with John Yates, a surveyor, and it was in the autumn trip. This is just after the ships left, of course, and winter's approaching, so a shorter daylight hours. And we did a bit of survey work low down. There were quite a number, all the parties were out working, about survey, geology and so on. And then John and I had to go up onto the plateau, about 5,000 odd feet up onto the plateau, I suppose. We got to our work area. As a surveyor, the plan was we would be measuring a line using a telerometer and setting up the odd light between the survey station we were to man and the one to the north. So we got there, and the weather was particularly bad. Communications were bad. We had long light periods, and it was pretty unpleasant, actually. I can remember temperatures in the low 30s, minus 30s, and strong winds. We were out in the field for about 6 weeks. We only had 2 working days out of that period. But we were waiting for a good day to do this survey, and because of the wind, we couldn't do it. Eventually, we did manage to get the work done. We were lying up in the tent for a further 5-6 days, running out of man food, running out of dog food. I remember by then we were feeding the dogs bits of nutty, you know, breaking down our own man food into small blocks. And you're going to feed the poor beggars in awful, you know, quite driving snow, blizzard sort of conditions. The poor beggars were really hungry. And I lay in my tent there, and we were running out of fuel as well. And all this hoarfrost inside, forming inside the tent, falling down on you. It was pretty unpleasant. And I said to John, you know, I said, John, we've got to move. We can't just lie here indefinitely. Because I was looking to him as sort of like being the second-year guy. He knew what he was doing. But I said, we can't just do this. So we did eventually leave. The weather it was blowing about 30 knots low drift to get his other depot to get some food, Beehive Depot. So we sledged up, we arrived up there. We could vaguely make out the outline of the Beehive, this hill. But we couldn't find the depot, so we camped again for another 2-3 days. And like a fool now, I didn't at the time. I just said to John, I'm just going outside. I took my compass with me. I thought, that depot's somewhere there. And I walked 50 yards due south, 50 yards due east, 50 due north and so on. So to box in, see if I could see anything. And I did pick out vaguely make out roughly where we were. We're on this like spur running away to the east, down to the last ice shelf. Anyway, I got back into the tent okay, having lost sight of the tent, but anyway, that's by the by. Next day we went out, we set up some marker poles, just kept in line. We walked on this bearing up this spur, and we got sight of the depot. So we went up there and got to the depot, thank God for that. One of the poor dogs had just about collapsed en route. Only this mile or so we went to the depot. We fed ourselves, we fed the dogs. Poor Enna, John's dog, she died from hypothermia and lack of food, obviously, the last few days. We were there for a couple of days, 2 or 3 days. Then we eventually got to the top of this, what is called Soda Bread Slope, tried to grope around, find out where the descent route was. We eventually did find it. The bamboo marker pole had been snapped off. It had been a period of about several weeks of really violent blows, and there'd been another party who'd experienced 100 knot winds to the north of us in the Forbes Glacier. Their tents had been ripped apart, and they'd had quite an epic getting back to Stonington. So we'd been through all that experience up on the plateau, but not quite so bad as what they had. But because of these really, really bad, violent strong winds, the whole surface on the plateau and everywhere had been blasted. Very, very heavy sastrugi, you know, the wavelength, rock-hard ice sastrugi. We got to the top of Soda Bread Slope to make our way down to get back to Stonington, and it was like a roller coaster ride, you know, it's like 4 foot, 5 foot high sastrugi. We got going down there, all the brakes wound around. This is in places about 1 in 2, 1 in 3 slope. We were going down there, sledges capsizing every so often. You have the dog teams out front, they always want to pull, wrap a load of ropes around the brake and dog chain things around the brake and everything else, around the runners rather. So we were going down anyway, to cut a long story short. I hit this sastrugi, catapulted over the top of my sledge down this crevasse. It knocked me unconscious. When I came to, John had already picked his dogs, and he was looking down this hole at me and saying, "Don't move." And I looked to my down one side of me. I said, I'm not going to move. I could see it was a gaping, great big abyss. If it had been a couple of a yard or so the other way, I'd have disappeared forever, without doubt. Anyway, so John rescued me out of the crevasse. I was coughing up blood and whatever, and I was in quite a state of shock, obviously, not realising it. But anyway, John got me out. We got the tent up and managed to radio. We couldn't make contact with Stonington because the HF transmissions weren't good locally like that, but we did raise a field party at Adelaide, some 50, 60, 70 miles away, and it was in that party was the doctor, Chris Andrews, on base at Adelaide, and John told him what the problem was, and I was listening into the radio, and Chris Andrews saying, get such and such an instrument out and do so, and I said, I'm going to be all right, John. but I was, suffering from quite a bit of shock, and I was in a lot of pain. But they radioed Stonington. Stonington sent out a rescue party for us the next day, and we got back to base. But I know that week or so on base, God, I was in an awful lot of pain. I really was. I remember getting up I couldn't even get up the stairs the first night or so. But
how did John get you out of the crevasse?
I can't. He obviously rigged up a rope system, and he got down to me. And I honestly can't really remember. I think it was. I was down about 30 foot down this crevasse, and thrown down onto a sort of subsidiary bridge, and there was a bit of a ramp leading down to it. And so he obviously came. It wasn't a vertical crevasse he had to get me out of, but. Sometime I shall see John, meet up with John again and ask him what he remembers about it.
Were you lucky?
I was lucky. If I'd have been a yard or so the other way, I'd have disappeared without doubt.
Tell me about the Admirals then. This is your dog team, isn't it? This is your first dog team.
It was, yeah. Yeah, they all the drivers had a great pride in their own dog team. And in fact, the Admirals were... as it turns out, the longest running, right from the Operation Tabarin days at Hope Bay. I think the Admirals were established then, and a continual team right the way through to me running, or to them virtually, well, being finished in the 1990s at Rothera. My team, the Admirals, and we all took great pride in them, and, you know, about the strength of the team and the characters and so on. So there was always that bit of competitiveness about your own team. And we, over the winter time, I organised a race round about a several mile circuit on the sea ice. You choose the best three dogs from your team, ski jawing around the ice at midwinter time and that sort of thing. But my lead bitch, Miff, and her two brothers, her siblings, Di and Waldo at the back of back pair, old Waldo, King Dog, great characters, you know, all of them. Problem was, when they'd not been running for a bit, there was always that unease amongst the team and scraps going on. But Miff, as soon as you stop the team, stop the sledge, Miff, as lead bitch, would come back, work her way back to her two brothers, Di and Waldo or whatever. And then the front pair, Sam and Kirsty, they'd come back with, and then a scrap would start. So the melee of dogs fighting, and of course they do quite a bit of damage to each other, so you're straight in with your rope thumper, dragging them apart. It was quite frustrating, an interesting experience, certainly the first time. But once you've been running with them for a few months, they get to know you and you get to know them, all their individual characteristics and so on. But an interesting and very hard work dog sledging. It wasn't the great romance as people think. If you've got a several hundred pound, 700 or 800, 900 pound, up to 1,000 pound load on a dog sledge, it's damned hard work in deep soft snow.
Were you raising pups to replace the dogs?
Yeah, we were still doing that, albeit they had said that the breeding program is to be cut back. Fuchs himself had, so it was quite a strict breeding program, and between the doggy man and Bob Bosselman the vet, and of course we had this long standing family tree of all the dogs bred in Antarctica, so it was a very strict breeding program, And then between the doggy man and Bob would say, right, well, so-and-so's due on heat, who shall we put her with? And so a dog, a good, powerful dog with good characteristics, you'd make the two together. And it was a very strict breeding programme that went on.
Well, how did you feel about the arrival of a new pup?
It didn't personally affect me because I didn't have any bitches which produced anyway, and it was the guy whose team the bitch had been in. It was up to him to choose the names for them and so on. So I'm sure he was quite proud, like a proud grandparent, whatever. So it never personally affected me, but certainly the pups on base were a great source of entertainment. You know, I can remember at Stonington there with the old lino floors and that. And as much as possible, when we were all on base, we had half a dozen, 8 or 9 pups in the building, at probably even more at any one time in the evening. And you'd be getting on with your work, and then you'd see all the puppy dogs there tearing about. Of course, they weren't house trained to be peeing and crapping everywhere. But it was great. I've got some lovely slides. I'll, you know, still look at them today of little puppy dogs there. I can remember 3 of them so messed up with sealskin meat and so on, filthy, and we'd given them a bath that night. And they looked absolutely immaculate, these 3 little forlorn pups sitting in the corner, all in pristine condition. But great, great source of entertainment. Everybody loved it, you know.
You were transferred to South Georgia again, weren't you, for the winter of 1974?
Yeah.
So was that against your wishes, or was that something you
wanted? Oh, no, I did what I was quite happy for a change. My thoughts on dog sledging, I did find it hard work, but I'd wanted to go to South Georgia as well anyway. And so when at the end of the season, or before the end of the season, you know, you request a base change. So I said, well, if there's any chance, I'd like to go to South Georgia. And again, no regrets, but in a way, because it was the end of the dogs and what turned out to be, you know, getting rid of all the dogs, I'm glad I wasn't there that last season.
That's Stonington, you mean?
Yeah, it was a pretty nasty what went on, really, and it upset. Well, the putting down of a load of dogs and so on, and you think those poor beggars had worked their hearts out for you, you know, and so it was a bit of a nasty business. I'm not sure we'd get away with it today, you know, culling of a lot of dogs the way it was. And I think it did upset some of the guys, you know, what happened. So
why were they being shot?
Well, they were told Stonington was being closed down, and they had to get rid of so many. They were told they could only, when we transferred to Rothera, to the new base being built at Rothera, it was on the cards anyway that dog sledging days were finishing. Dick Laws, who had taken over from Fuchs, as good as said, that's it, dog sledging's finished. And quite rightly so. I mean, it's... anyway, that's something else. But so they did say only so many dogs could be taken over to Rothera. And that's what happened. I wasn't involved in it, but some of the stories I do hear, it was... You know, it wasn't. People weren't too happy with what went on.
So, what were you doing in that winter of '74 at South Georgia? You were a boatman of sorts, I believe.
Yeah, I went to South Georgia as a boatman. You know, I did boat building anyway in my apprenticeship in the Royal Navy, and I love working with my tools. I went there as boatman and boatman handyman, as indeed anybody with a basic general handyman knowledge, you get involved in all sorts of jobs. But again, it was a fantastic year. It was a lovely winter. And South Georgia, I've got very, very, very fond memories of the place. It was a cracking winter. And good boating days, mountaineering activities, good walking there, everything about the place.
People describe the Manx to me quite a lot. The weather conditions are not particularly salubrious, is that right?
Well, South Georgia? Mm. It can be, but equally, you know, down the peninsula we had some pretty manky days up on the dreaded Larsen Mank and so on. But, yeah, it's very much a maritime climate as opposed to deep down the Antarctic peninsula. I suppose you get more of a continental climate. So it is very, you know, very fickle, the weather is there. And
so you came to the end of your 2.5-year stretch. And what were the options at that point?
The options, I don't know whether they didn't normally like you doing three consecutive winters anyway, so that was never really an option, not that I wanted to.
Was there a reason for that, do you think? Was there a reason why they didn't?
Oh, I think so. I think Bass rightly think or assume that, after you don't want to become totally apart from civilization, from women and everything else. And I think when you've done 2.5 years with a group of blokes in an isolated community like that, then it is time to get back and face the realities of life. And I was certainly looking forward to it. You know, I miss female company, and I missed, I was missing home as well. So I was quite looking forward to getting home.
Did they ask me to come back too?
Did they ask me to come back?
No, did you have something to come back to back in Britain?
Somebody.
Something.
Awesome. I'd had a girlfriend. I had a very nice girlfriend before I left. But something to come back to.
Was she still there when you came back?
No, she wasn't. No, she'd buggered off to Australia.
So had you a Dear John there?
I got the Dear John when I was down at Stonington, yeah.
What was that like?
Hmm?
What was that like? Opening the mail? And...
We had this business called the Old Ching Letter. How the name... I've heard various... various reasons why they call it the Ching Letter, and anyway, it didn't bother me too much. I mean, okay, I wasn't madly in love or anything like that. She was a girlfriend. I was quite keen. And anyway, there we go. So, but something to come back to. Not really. I didn't have any work to come back to, but I was quite looking forward to it. And I had a bit of money to spend anyway, because you spent 2.5 years down there. And relatively speaking, the pay wasn't good in those days, but it was still pretty good. When you think it's all found and we were taxed at the Falkland Islands tax rate, income tax rate. So it was pretty good. I had a bit of money in the bank when I came home. And I really can't remember. But
you hadn't spent any money, was
you? Oh, I hadn't spent anything at all, apart from... old Jerry Cutland, bless him, was the purser, on the John Biscoe, and old Jerry used to manage to sell most fids who were going south a sophisticated bit of radio gear or hi-fi gear or camera gear, whatever. So apart from spending a bit of money to go into Jerry's pocket, then no, I hadn't spent much at all.
So what did you do when you for work when you got back to the UK?
I went down again the following season anyway, and I don't think I really can't remember what I did the first season, but I had so many jobs. I went down on a number of occasions, came back, went down again, had many, many jobs. I think the first time I didn't work at all. I went back straight away the following season back down to South Georgia by choice.
Got a note here saying you were repairing snowplows. Maybe that was another occasion.
Well, it was, yeah. I subsequently came back from South Georgia, and then I had a couple of years at home, and I did get a job with the County Council, Lincolnshire County Council. I was in the workshops there, and went for a friend of mine who was in charge of the workshop. Said, well, can you, I said, any chance of any work? He said, yeah, what can you do? I said, well, I can weld, I can do a bit of woodwork, whatever. He said, right, welding up the snowplow fleet. So that's what I did. And it was interesting. Prefabricating highways, caravans, and doing jobs like that. It was interesting work, actually. And at the main boss, he said, oh, we've got a... he was building these chassis for small trucks, caravans, trailers, whatnot. I didn't realise it. He was selling and making money on the side. They got rid of him in the end. I'd be welding up all these damn things. But I did that job for a bit. And
but were you itching to go south again?
Not immediately, no. But because I did... did several other jobs. I wanted to go back down to South Georgia again, and I did that the following season. Then I did that winter, and then I came back home, had a winter at home, and then I had a couple of years summer season field work on South Georgia. In the interim, the winters, I'd got a job skiing instructing up in the Cairngorms, and I worked offshore for a while with BP I was off while I was working offshore. I read the Press and Journal newspaper or whichever, Northern Scott, and I saw them advertising for a reindeer keeper. I thought, oh, I could do that job. It sounds interesting, in the Kingholm. So I applied for a job and I got that. That was one of the most interesting periods of my life. But I'd said, you know, I went for an interview and they said, what do you know about reindeer? I said, oh, I've worked with reindeer before. We had a veterinary program with the South Georgia reindeer and I had assisted the vet down there. So, yeah, I got the job as keeper of the reindeer herd for a few months.
Let's explore the second part of your career after we had a break.
Yep, okay, fine.